You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins, on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna. So I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. If you've heard me speak for any amount of time at all, you've probably heard me mention GEMS, G-E-M-S. Today, I want to talk to you about how I came across GEMS, why it's important, and how and why it works. My daughter, Shayna, passed away back in 2015. People, of course, started giving me advice, and all of it was well-intended. I will say all of it was well-intended. But some of it was helpful and some of it was less than helpful. I realized after several years later, I didn't realize at the time, that there were some basic categories that the advice fell into. Frankly, at the very beginning, I didn't want any of it because what I really wanted was my daughter back. I wanted to not just sleep through a night. I wanted to sleep for the rest of my life. I didn't want to wake up. I wanted to stop feeling like I was drowning on dry land. I wasn't looking for a self-improvement plan. I was looking for just relief from the pain that I was in and the way I felt like I didn't want to go on. But over time, these practices started to land, and I started testing some of them out, and I tested them, and I found out that they worked. There were four of these practices that became a big part of the reason while I'm still here. The reason why I'm talking to you today, because I started doing these things on a regular basis. It's not because I went hunting for these particular things, because frankly, one at a time, they found me. And that's the GEMS that I'm going to talk to you about today. Today, I'm not going to tell you how to do GEMS, and that's going to be next week. Today, I want to tell you how I found each one of these practices, usually when I was actually not interested at all, and why, once I finally stopped fighting, that every single one of them worked. So with that, welcome to After the Storm. Let me take you back to those first months. Grief in the beginning isn't really an emotion. In fact, I heard grief described as a container for emotions. Grief isn't one thing. It's a landscape. It's a vast, uncharted wilderness. And you're standing in the middle of it, with no map and no compass, no idea which way to go, no ability to even see. It's almost like you're standing there in the dark and you've got maybe a match lighting the way, right? You could see like a foot in front of your face. Every single breath feels like a struggle. I mean, literally, you can't imagine yourself making it to the afternoon, let alone to the next day or the next week or the next month. When people will talk about years down the line, I would literally get angry. It was like tunnel vision. I could not see that far, and it frustrated me. And then, frankly, I didn't want to see that far. The plans, the dreams, the moments that my daughter and I still had coming, they were all cut short. Shayna was only 15 years old when she passed away, so I, frankly, did not want to be here. And the one thing that I really wanted more than anything was sleep. That was my escape. I looked forward to going to bed at night, closing my eyes, and just not being here in this place anymore. And the one thing that you want so much when you're in grief sometimes is a thing that you can't get, because you lie in bed and you can't shut your mind off. It just keeps racing, and your mind just is like a hamster on a wheel, and you just can't fall asleep. Or if you fall asleep, you can't stay asleep. So the nights become long and full of torment. And then during the day, you're exhausted. And the days are even harder because you can't get to sleep. So I knew somewhere underneath all of that surviving this was going to take more than just gritting my teeth and enduring. I couldn't keep going just the way that I was. Something had to change. Enduring isn't living. And I had two people counting on me to actually live, to actually get back to some semblance of normalcy. And that's my wife, Tawana, and my daughter, Kayla. So what did I do? I did what an engineer does. And that's what my background is engineering. I went looking for data. I buried myself in books. I founded an organization called Helping Parents Heal. It's an organization of, at that time, it was a few thousand parents who had children who had passed away. And I submerged myself in the Helping Parents Heal. I looked for help around me. I sought out stories of people who had walked in this same wilderness and somehow found their way back. And somewhere in all that searching, a pattern started to surface. And it came in four small pieces. It wasn't one grand revelation. I didn't wake up one day and go, oh, gems, that's the answer. These four practices kept showing up. They showed up in the research. They showed up in the stories of the people that I looked at around me. They showed up in the mouths of the people who had found their footing again. And I want to be honest with you about how I actually met each one, because you might be standing exactly where I was, being handed these words and wanting to throw them right back. And I want to start with the one I fought the hardest, and that's gratitude. Everybody told me gratitude would change my life. Everybody. And I resented every one of them a little for saying it. Because, again, I'm a really practical person. I'm a down-to-earth, like, how does this work kind of person. And I've heard about manifestation, for example, and they say if you're just grateful for what you have, then you'll get more of what you want. And I don't know if I buy that or not. That's for another time. But I'm like, how would that possibly work? But here's the thing, and I want you to know this for yourself if you're in grief or if you're speaking to someone in grief. When you're speaking to someone who's just lost a child or just lost a spouse or has a terminal diagnosis or whatever it might happen to be, they're so narrowly focused on that, that when you say gratitude, they'll say, what do you think is going right in my life? Because you just can't see what's going right in your life. Have you just tried being grateful? Sounds almost obscene, because you can only focus on the thing that's going wrong. People that ask, tell you the list of things you're grateful for, you're going to list the things that have been taken away from you. So when someone said gratitude, it felt like being asked to smile, to be grateful for the very thing that broke me. So for a long time, I just rejected this whole idea of gratitude. And then I was listening to this pastor at a Unity Church in Phoenix, Arizona. And he was giving some things, you know, tips. They call it new thought. So, you know, changing the way you think. And there was I would call it a challenge. I wouldn't even call it a practice. It was a challenge. And it wasn't journaling. This was a single phrase. And the instruction was to repeat this phrase 100 times a day for 100 days. So again, I'm not a believer that this magically changed the universe. I think now, you know, years later, there may be something to that as well, that we are co-creators. But this challenge was to say this: every day in every way, my life is getting better and better and better. Now, if you've ever tried affirmations before, you may realize that a lot of times while we're saying it either out loud or in our minds, there's another little voice in the back of our mind going, this is baloney. This is bullcrap. This isn't really working. This isn't really even true. But I did it. And my skeptical engineering brain hated this. It felt like I was lying to myself. My life wasn't getting better and better and better every single day. My life had come apart at the seams. But I tried it. 100 times a day is a lot of times, and something strange starts to happen. Around all these repetitions, your brain starts actually hunting for evidence that the phrase might be true. There's a little bit of whatever the reverse of doubt is, right? There's a little bit of belief that I guess kind of creeps in and says, if I'm saying this, is there any evidence that it's true? And, you know, I was getting a little better maybe every day. And, you know, there were some things that were still going right. My brain started to hunt for small things. And this is the thing about gratitude. You know, there's never going to be a time in your life where everything is perfect. There are always going to be things that are going wrong. But on the other hand, there are also a million things going right. I was listening to a guy talk recently about health and our bodies. And he was saying that even when you're ill, even when you have the most serious illness there is, there's still thousands of things going right for you to be able to sit upright, to have a conversation, to be able to walk, to be able to see. There are all these things that are going right. And of course, we focus on the thing that's going wrong. So I start to notice little things. The coffee was good. The shower was warm. The air conditioning was working if it was summer, or the heat was working if it was winter. So I wasn't manufacturing gratitude. I wasn't just pulling something out of thin air. What I started doing, frankly, was noticing what's already there. And to my surprise, it actually worked. And that phrase, by the way, the phrase, every day and every way, my life is getting better and better and better. It's about 100 years old. There's a French psychologist named Emile Coué who gave a version of it to his patients back in the 1920s. And he noticed that what people repeat to themselves, they slowly start to become. He was early to something science would spend the next century proving. We all repeat things to ourselves, and you know it. You know there's just messages that our brain just delivers to us over and over and over again. So I'm going to tell you why this works. Our brain has what's called a negativity bias. Our ancestors survived by scanning for threats. The rustle in the grass, the shadow past the firelight in the evening. The ones who assumed the worst lived long enough to become somebody's great-great-grandparents and pass their genes along. If you were a person who ignored danger, you died early, and so you weren't there to pass your genes along. Survivors were the ones that looked around for danger. Now, that wiring kept our species alive. We needed that back in the day because life was full of physical dangers. Our lives are no longer usually full of physical dangers. If you're living a modern life in a modern place, you're probably relatively safe right now. There's nothing coming to get you. There's nothing you really need to be aware of in your physical surroundings. In a modern life, and especially in grief, what happens, our mind defaults to what's wrong. It defaults to what's missing. It defaults to what hurts. Gratitude is how you retrain your mind. It's how you overcome that core basic instinct that's deep inside your brain. This comes back to something called neural pathways. This is biology. This is efficiency. Our brains are wired to be efficient. So this happens next, or this happened, and this is how we should respond. And we develop these pathways, these really basically shortcuts. That negativity bias is there to notice things that are bad. Every time you deliberately notice something good, you lay down a new neural pathway. Now, there's some great things about our brains, and one of them is called neuroplasticity. We can retrain our brains. We can rework those pathways. If you'd imagine, like, there's a stimulus, something happens, and there's a response that we normally go to, that's a pathway. We can lay down a new pathway, and you do it long enough, and that pathway becomes easier and easier and easier. And I can tell you, after years of doing that, that pathway becomes the default pathway. You start noticing the things that are right without even having to practice it. You're not pretending that the pain isn't there. We're not here to fool ourselves. What we're doing, though, is basically think of it like this. You're kind of widening the lens. When you're in grief, when things are going wrong, our lens focuses down. It narrows down. What we're doing is we're just widening the lens to notice all the good things that are going on. The pain is there, but it's not all that there is. And the research here is not soft. There's a Dr. Robert Emmons. He spent his entire career on this. His studies show that people who keep a simple gratitude practice report more well-being, less depression, and less stress than people who don't. His grateful subjects even reported fewer aches and pains. They physically felt healthier. A more recent trial followed more than 1,300 people. The ones who were asked to write down what they were grateful for just for 2 weeks, okay, this is not years or months, 2 weeks, they came out happier and more satisfied with their lives and less depressed. And it held even after the 2 weeks were done. Even after they stopped writing it down for 2 weeks, they developed a new habit, a new way of thinking. So here's a find that matters most for you and me. Researchers have looked specifically at gratitude in grieving people. What they found is that gratitude tracks with something called post-traumatic growth. And post-traumatic growth is what Grief to Growth, which is my company, my brand, is all about. You hear me always talk about grief to growth. This is about this post-traumatic growth. This is the real measurable way people don't just survive a loss, but are genuinely transformed by it. The more gratitude, the more growth. The more gratitude, the less anxiety. The more gratitude, the less depression. There's a framework that I lean on here. A few years ago, I took something called positive intelligence from a man named Shirzad Shamin. And Shirzad says your mind is run by basically two types of voices.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
There are saboteurs, the main one being what he calls the judge, and they pump out fear and stress. And then the second part of you, the second type of voice you have, is your sage. That's the calm, clear, wise part of you. And I would say that is actually your true self, capital S. That is your higher self. That is who you are at your core. Gratitude activates the sage. Every time you choose gratitude, you hand the microphone, as it were, to the wisest part of yourself. And you take that microphone away from the cruelest part of yourself. Now, those other parts of you are never going to go away. And they're there for a reason, as I said. So we're not here to completely get rid of them. But we can start to listen to the sage more. On my list of gems, I will admit that gratitude is one I've fought harder than anything else. I'm really glad that I tried it. I'm glad that I stuck with it. And I can tell you, if you're a skeptic like I am and you're sitting there going, this doesn't make any sense, I said the same thing. All I can tell you is try it. And I'm giving you the science behind it. I'm giving you the research behind it. I'm not saying it's magically going to make your pain go away. It certainly will not. I'm not saying you're never going to feel bad again or feel depressed again. That's not a promise either. But what I am saying is it will change the way that you look at things, and you can start to see that there are so many more things going right in your life than there are going wrong. And I can say that to you with confidence, no matter what circumstance you're in right now. So that's gratitude. The second pillar is exercise, and I also include sleep with that. Here's the thing that's really interesting to me about the human body. We need to move our bodies, and we also need to rest our bodies. Too far out of balance either way is not good. If we're not getting enough sleep, if we're not getting enough rest, we become out of balance, and we don't function optimally. But on the other hand, if we were too sedentary, and we're not getting exercise, and we're not moving our bodies, ironically, that will actually lower your energy levels. The thing about this one, though, I didn't discover exercise after Shayna passed. I started exercising pretty early in my life and would do things all my life, either lifting weights or walking, going to the gym, whatever it is. And before Shayna passed, I had started walking, and I've been walking for years. I think I was walking at the time maybe like 2 miles a day. But something changed after Shayna passed. The walking wasn't just exercise for my body. It became a ritual. It became intentional. And it became, and I really mean this word in a sense, it became sacred. It became a time I looked forward to every day. And let me tell you what my walks turned into. Now, before I go too far down this walking path, I want to say this to you. Whatever exercise works for you is the one that works for you. I'm not suggesting that everybody should walk. I am suggesting that almost everybody can walk. I am saying it doesn't require any money. It doesn't require any special equipment. And there's some really beneficial things about walking if you can do it as opposed to, you know, maybe other forms of exercise. I like it because it's simple. I like it because it doesn't require any equipment. I don't have to go anywhere, get my car, go to the gym, etc. For me, walking started, I got a Fitbit many years ago, and you probably remember they said you're supposed to walk 10,000 steps a day for optimal health. I have a pretty long stride. For me, 10,000 steps a day turned out to be almost 6 miles. I would get up early and take my walk. But when Shayna passed, I actually started giving each step a meaning. I pictured every step as one day of my life. I would take these steps and I would actually leave my house, and I would think of it almost as like being, we're born into the world. I would leave my house, I would start out, and then at some point I would turn to come home, and then I would, when I reached the house again, that was kind of me picturing myself at the end of my life, at the end of my journey. And I started seeing that ritual of doing that every day as a way to, I don't know, it's kind of a meditative thing for me. And sometimes I would just turn off the music or the podcast or whatever it was I wanted to listen to that day. And I would just focus on the steps, focusing on the days. It's really interesting how that kind of developed out of, I don't know, it just developed for me. I would have this picture of every day taking this loop. And when I would come back to the front door, I felt like I was coming back to Shayna, back home, back toward her. Because I don't believe that my daughter is gone. I believe that she's exactly where I'm walking toward. Her body died. She did not. She is right now as real as she's ever been. And she loves me every bit as much as she always has. The walking stopped becoming just exercise. It's still exercise, but it became the most reliable prayer that I have. A prayer with my whole body that I do for an hour and 40 minutes every morning. Let's go to the science. Why does movement do so much for a grieving body and mind? Well, a lot of it comes down to chemistry. We are basically chemical beings. It's funny because I always say we are not biological robots in a meaningless universe, but we are biology. We are chemistry. It's a big part of that mind-body thing that I talked about, the mind-body connection. When you move, your brain releases dopamine, the neurotransmitter tied to motivation, reward, and plain old just feeling good. Regular exercise doesn't just give you a hit of dopamine. Over time, it builds more dopamine receptors, so your brain uses what it has more efficiently. Doing this regular exercise drives neuroplasticity, your brain's power to rewire and form new connections. So one is the physical movement, and one is the thoughts that you have. The other thing about moving your body is it lowers cortisol, the stress hormone that grief floods you with. And we talked last week about how cortisol affects your body and how it spikes when you're in a grief situation, when you're in a stress situation. So we want to lower that. And when you exercise, you're literally turning down the chemical volume on your stress, and you're turning up the chemistry of motivation and hope. This is why exercise is so important. And I want you to hear how strong the evidence is, because I know that go for a walk can land like a brush off, right? Why don't you go take a walk? In 2024, researchers pooled more than 200 studies, over 14,000 people. This is what they call a meta-analysis on exercise and depression. Their conclusion was that exercise is an effective treatment for depression. I know there's an epidemic of anxiety, depression, etc. right now, and there are drugs that are being prescribed to people, and I'm not opposed to drugs at all. I've been on antidepressants myself, but exercise can be helpful, and it's a nice little add-on. And that analysis, it stood shoulder to shoulder with therapy and medication. So I want to say this plainly. Movement is medicine. Movement helps your body the same way that therapy or the same way that medication can. Not against therapy at all, not against medication at all. But if you can move, move. The prescription is free. You already own it, and there are no side effects. If you can walk outdoors, do it outdoors. The open air stacks benefit on top of benefit. Sunlight lifts serotonin. It's another feel-good chemical, the one the antidepressants work on. And it resets the body clock the grief throws into chaos. And even if you're not getting direct, bright sunlight directly on your skin, any amount of time outdoors is helpful for boosting your serotonin levels. Sunlight also gives you vitamin D, and low vitamin D levels are linked to depression. Probably most of us are low on vitamin D. Vitamin D is really, really important for a lot of things, but also for mood. Just being out in nature itself lowers stress. There's even a name for our pull toward. It's called biophilia. We are drawn to nature. I live in a suburb, and when I walk, it's not in the woods or anything, but I do see trees, I see grass, I see all kinds of wildlife, rabbits, turtles, snakes, ducks, geese, hawks, etc. And just seeing those things, there's something about that pull towards us that actually helps to lift our mood. These are all the benefits I get from walking. My exercise of choice, walking for me, is actually the humblest one there is. There's no equipment, there's no membership, but I walk pretty much 365 days a year. The only thing it costs me is a couple pairs of shoes a year. I do have to change my shoes every 6 months because I walk a lot of miles. There's another thing about walking, and it's small. Well, it's not small. It's actually pretty big, but it's almost magical. A short walk after a meal, even 2 minutes, helps your muscles pull the sugar out of your blood before it can spike. Your whole body runs better. That's not just folk wisdom. It's in the research. Let's talk about the twin of exercise, sleep. In the early days of grief, sleep might be the cruelest joke of all. It's the one escape that you're desperate for, and it's the one thing that your mind won't allow you to do. You can't get to sleep. When you get to sleep, you can't stay asleep. You might have vivid dreams that may not be pleasant, constant waking. So I actually had to work to get back to a place where sleep came easily. Now, I was fortunate. I had a friend, and this is not medical advice, but I had a friend that after Shayna passed, knew that grieving people had trouble sleeping and gave me melatonin. And melatonin is a natural chemical that's released that helps to make us sleepy. It works on our circadian rhythm. And a lot of times when we're under stress, et cetera, our melatonin cycle gets off. So I took melatonin every night for quite a while. I'm not suggesting everybody run out and buy melatonin, but you might want to check it out. It worked for me. I found that it made me more relaxed, more sleepy, and I was able to stay asleep. But exercise is a big part of also getting back to where sleep becomes more easily, because just being able to tire yourself out. A body that's moved during the day is a body that's ready to rest at night. So exercise and sleep actually feed each other. I think it's really interesting how our bodies need both. We need to move during the day so that we can sleep at night. I really got help from a woman named Delphi Ellis, D-E-L-P-H-I Ellis. She came on my podcast and she wrote a book called Answers in the Dark. It's about sleep for people carrying grief and anxiety. Highly, highly recommend that book if you're having trouble sleeping, or even if you're not, it'll really help you understand a lot about sleep. And sleep maintenance, I would call it, is really important. You may have heard these things before, but I'm going to repeat them because I think it's really helpful. You want to make your bedroom a sanctuary. We had a TV in our bedroom when we first got married, and had a TV in our bedroom for a very long time. And then we realized one day, like, we never turn the TV on. We don't watch TV in the bedroom. It's not really good to have that blue light before you go to sleep, because the blue light from your screens tells your brain it's time to be awake. So you want to turn your screens off before you go to bed. But you want to make sure your bedroom is cool. And as much as I love the heat, and I love the heat, I find I can't sleep if it's too warm. So you want to make sure your bedroom is cool. You want to make sure your bedroom is dark. And you want to make sure your bedroom is quiet. You want to build a wind down routine so your body knows that rest is coming. In my case, I have an Apple Watch. And my Apple Watch tells me I've got set for bedtime is 10 o'clock. But 9:45, the little chime goes off and says, you've got 15 minutes. It's time to go to bed. That's just a little signal to my brain saying it's time to wind down. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't settle, if your mind is racing, what I do is I meditate. Find what quiets your mind, whatever works for you, but find something that can help quiet your mind. I noticed one time, and I was in bed and my hip was hurting. Every way I turned, my hip was just was hurting. And I could not get to sleep because of the pain. So something came to me and said, try meditating. So I tried doing the meditation. The meditation, I'm not going to say the pain went away. It was still there, but I wasn't focused on it. And when I wasn't focused on it, it was just about as good as it going away. I was able to fall asleep. It's the same thing when you have your mind racing and going to negative thoughts. Find something else to put your mind on. Do some sort of meditation. Repeat a mantra. Find something else to focus on. Find what quiets your mind and calms your mind. Sleep is a really weird thing that our bodies and our minds need. It's not just downtime. It's not just that we're turning off. In fact, our brains never turn off. While you sleep, your brain is doing the work of processing emotion and filing away memory. So for a grieving mind with a mountain of both to carry, emotion and memories, sleep is where a lot of the healing actually happens. So don't think of your brain as just like going offline when you sleep. Your brain is still doing its thing. It's still sorting things out for you, and you need that sleep. The research is blunt about this. Chronic poor sleep raises your risk of depression and anxiety. We also need to dream. People that are deprived from dreaming can't last very long and stay sane. When you're having stress, anxiety, depression, anyway, because of your grief, you don't want to pair that with chronic poor sleep. Studies on grief specifically show that bad sleep makes grief worse and it slows the healing down. But protecting your sleep is not a luxury. It's absolutely necessary.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Pillar 3. Mindfulness. My history with mindfulness was pretty spotty. I dabbled with meditation. I'd meditate every once in a while. I knew what it was. I'd sit down. I'd do it for a few days. I'd feel good about myself, and then I'd let it slide. And this may sound familiar to you. Grief is what finally made my meditation practice stick. And it started on those walks. When I was taking my walk, I would pay attention to the rhythm of my steps. I would feel the ground underneath my feet. I would feel the breeze on my face. I would focus on the birds singing. And I wasn't escaping the moment. I was landing right in the middle of it. So rather than go to the past where there might be regrets or anger, or going to the future where there might be fear, I would focus on staying right where I was. That's the whole secret of mindfulness, by the way. You hear about meditation, you hear about mindfulness. These are two very similar words. Some people would argue they're the same. Some people would argue they're different. But mindfulness is just being fully here, in this moment. This is the only moment that actually exists. So when we talk about mindfulness, it's not turning off your mind. It's not stopping all thoughts. It's just noticing and being in the present moment. The thing about mindfulness is you can literally do it anywhere. You don't need a cushion and an altar. I have a cushion. I have an altar. But you don't need those things to practice mindfulness. For me, I love technology. I found an app called Insight Timer. I like Insight Timer. It's got thousands of free guided meditations and ambient sound. But the thing that really hooked me is that it tracks your streak. How many days in a row you've shown up. I like having that counter, that thing that says, okay, you're doing good. You've meditated so many days in a row. But I'll also tell you this about meditation. The first person I learned it really from or heard about from was a Buddhist teacher. And he likened meditation to brushing your teeth. It's like you brush your teeth every day. So I don't know if your mind has teeth or not, but you brush your teeth every day. You need to take care of your mind every day. Now, you don't have to meditate for 20, 30 minutes, 40, an hour. You can meditate for 5 minutes to start. And I would recommend, if you haven't practiced mindfulness before, start with 5 minutes. So why does sitting and paying attention do anything for grief? Because grief lives in these two tenses that don't exist. Grief lives in the past, and it lives in the future. The past that you can't change, and the future that you're terrified of. Mindfulness keeps gently walking you back to the one place that's actually real, now. And right now, in this exact second, you are almost always okay. It's the time traveling that tortures us. Or when I was living in anger or regret, it's like you're living in the past. When I was living in fear, it's like you're living in the future. When I would have panic attacks, it wasn't about what was going on in that moment. It was about what I feared coming in the next moment. If I said to you right now, where are you? You're probably sitting somewhere. You're listening to this. You're probably warm, cool. You're fed. You have water. You're okay in this moment. When you start to have fear, it's when you're living in the future, as I said. So the science is caught up with what contemplatives learned thousands of years ago. A major review published in the Journal of American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, found that mindfulness meditation programs meaningfully reduce anxiety, depression, and pain. Other studies show it physically changes the parts of the brain tied to focus and emotional regulation. So are you seeing how these things go together? The gratitude practice, reforming our brain. The exercise, reforming our brain. The mindfulness practice, reforming our brain. All these things work together cohesively to help change our brain, to help us practice what's called emotional regulation. And that's a phrase to hold on to. Grief is a storm of feelings, and mindfulness is how you learn to feel the storm without being swept away by it. I'm not saying we're turning off our feelings. It's very important that we feel our feelings, but we want to be able to regulate our emotions. When you quiet your mind, you can finally start to hear your own thoughts, your true thoughts, and you can start to catch the saboteurs. Because the thing about that positive intelligence thing I told you earlier, it's one thing to know that we have a judge and that we've got the sage and we've got these other saboteurs, but it's really important to be able to catch ourselves in those moments and go back to the sage. And that going back, that practice of going from somewhere where we don't want to be to somewhere we want to be, that's the muscle we work on when we're practicing mindfulness. So you start to catch these saboteurs in the act. And once you can hear them, once you can identify them, you can choose not to believe them. You can say, nope, I'm going to hand the mic back to the sage. So mindfulness is what lets you notice the negative thought before it runs off with your whole afternoon. It's the pause between what happens to you and how you respond. When you have the stimulus, something happens, and you pause and you choose how you're going to act, how you're going to respond. In that pause is your freedom. So now we're going on to the fourth pillar, and that's self-care. This is the one that actually came last for me. And I'm going to be straight with you. This one for me is a complete stranger. There wasn't a single moment when I discovered it. The other three I can kind of point to. This one came slowly and late, and mostly through working with my clients. This is the thing about me and a lot of my clients. I'm kind of a recovering high achiever. I'm a grind it out kind of person. I'm like the do whatever it takes to get it done kind of person. For me, self-care was like, that's for other people. I'm here to get things done. As I was coaching people, I could see it in them. And I guess I could see it in them because it was in me. And I was telling them, you need to slow down. And the thing is, our saboteurs will all tell us the reason why you got here, the reason why you are where you are, the reason why you're such a high achiever is because you're so relentless, because you grind, because you don't accept second best. You're a perfectionist, and that's a good thing. This is how we got here. And you need me, you know, because if you didn't have this, you would be just a lazy bum. When the grief hits, what do? We reach for the only tool we know. We try to power through that too. I think about a couple of my clients I have that are former military, and they're like, okay, well, what's the plan? I need to have a 10-point plan, a 5-point plan. I'm going to work the plan and plan the work, and then I'll be done with this. And that's the way that we try to power through grief. Here's what every one of us learns the hard way. If you're growing a plant, I'm growing plants right now. It takes time for the fruit to come on the tomato plant. We bought them weeks ago. And first the plant grows some, and then you start to see some flowers, and then you see these little tiny green tomatoes, and it's weeks, months before you actually get a tomato. You can't rush that process. You can't power that plant through. You can't scream at it. You can't just pour more water on it. It's going to take 500 gallons to grow this plant, so I'm just going to dump all 500 gallons of water on it today. The harder you try to do that, the harder you push on your grief, the harder you try to manage it as a project, actually, frankly, the harder it pushes back. High achievers a lot of times feel guilty because they can't handle this the way they handle everything else. I should be able to do this. People pleasers feel like they're letting everyone around them down because they're not the same person that they used to be. I have a friend that very recently lost their spouse, and they're like, I'm not the person that I used to be. And it's like, of course you're not. Of course you're not the person you used to be. And frankly, I have good news and bad news. You're probably never going to be the person you used to be because these things change us. But what also sometimes runs underneath this is this quiet, brutal belief that I don't deserve to feel better. I'm not able to handle this. I'm not doing it right, so I don't deserve to feel better. And I want to say this to you directly. I want you to really hear it. You do deserve to feel better. We all deserve to feel better. But we can't just flip a switch and get there. And I want to tell you this also. Self-care that I'm going to talk about is not selfish. The words sound alike. They both have the word self in them, but they're not the same thing. You've heard the expression, you cannot pour from an empty cup. So why is self-care not selfish? Because you can't pour from an empty cup. You can't carry your family. You can't honor your person that's passed on. You can't heal your own heart while running on nothing. So I want you to think of recharging as a thing that makes everything else we've talked about possible. All the other things that we're talking about, you need to have energy to do. You don't have to earn rest. It's not a prize you get to claim once you've earned it. It's a right. So I want you to stop filing self-care under luxury. I want you to file self-care under brushing your teeth. It's non-negotiable. It's basic maintenance for a human being. And I've seen this. I know that recovering from our grief or healing from our grief, whatever word you want to use, is a choice. It's something that we can choose, whether we want that to happen or not. Being kind to yourself is part of how you get through. It's not indulgence, and it's certainly not weakness. Now, as I said, self-care came to me last, but now I tell you it's the ground the other three stand on. So that's how these things found me. Gratitude, I came kicking and screaming. Exercise transformed what was a habit that was based purely on the physical into like a daily prayer that I do with my body and my mind for an hour and 40 minutes in the morning. Mindfulness became something I do every day, finally sticking after years of just letting it slip away. And self-care, the thing that I really hadn't thought about much at all before, that was the stranger to me that turned out to be the foundation. Here's what took me a while to see. And I'm telling you today, hopefully you can see it long before I do. These four are not four separate fixes. They're actually one system. They hold each other up. I practice some form of each one of these every single day. I get up in the morning, I do some gratitude practice. I exercise. I will sit for 5, 10, 20 minutes once or twice a day, and I do something for self-care. Well, here's how these kind of things go hand in hand. Exercise helps you sleep. Sleep gives you the steadiness to be mindful. Mindfulness helps you catch the negative thought, so the gratitude can be your response and answer that negative thought. Gratitude softens the guilt that actually blocks your self-care, because if you feel like you don't deserve to feel better, then you're not going to practice self-care. And self-care gives you the fuel to get up and take the walk. Round and around and around it goes. These things feed on each other. So sometimes we think of spiraling as in terms of spiraling down. I like to think of spiraling this in case of spiraling up. Each of these things builds to the next thing, and it just, it lifts you and lifts you and lifts you. So that's why I put these things together into what I call gems. Again, not because any single one of these is a miracle, not because I discovered any of these things, I didn't, but because for me, together, they became this foundation, this practice that holds me up physically, mentally, and spiritually all at the same time. And I want you to notice what none of them is. None of them is get over it. None of them is move on. None of them ask you to leave your loved one behind. None of them ask you to pretend that this doesn't suck. They give you a strong enough sense of self to keep loving your loved one and to keep living, to do both at once. So next week, we're going to roll up our sleeves, and I'm going to go deeper into how to begin each one of these. The smallest possible first step for gratitude, for movement, and for sleep, for mindfulness, and for self-care. No overwhelm, one doable thing at a time. I'm a big believer in baby steps. We're going to talk about how do we do this. Here's what I want you to carry out of today. You don't have to go find these practices. If you just stay a little open, even while you're resisting like I was, they, I believe, will find you. They found me at my lowest, and I wasn't even looking. I was only desperate enough to eventually say yes. So maybe you say yes a little sooner than I did. So whatever you're facing tonight, you're not being buried under it, no matter how it feels. You're being planted in it, and what's planted can grow. I'm Brian Smith. This is After the Storm, and I'll be right here when the healing continues. Thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral 2, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins. Continues.